Hey, so we are back for the second hour of the show. We've got a second hour tonight, John.
It's nice. It's nice to have a second hour.
It's nice. It's a rarity.
Very.
It's like when you haven't had sex for a long time, you hit the 9-minute mark and you're like, well, look at this.
No.
Look at what happened tonight.
No, I do not know. What's the 9-minute mark like?
No neck, John Gardner. Can't quite get to the neck, and that's okay. We are back with our second hour. I want to thank Ben Harrell again from Dark Soul Studios for talking about his feature he's got in the works and his short films. Again, another kindred soul sort of coming on to the Night Terrors Radio podcast. Mm-hmm. Now we have Jim Lesniak. Now, Jim, we know Jim. At least I'm breaking down the fourth wall here.
Sure.
I know Jim. Because Jim is a local guy. We've got two sort of semi-local guys on tonight, which we don't normally have either.
It's nice to have.
Because it's usually the Canadian invasion.
It is.
Even though we haven't, we're over 40 episodes in, which is astonishing that I've stuck to anything that long.
It really is.
But we are 40 episodes in, and now we've only had about 5 or 6 episodes that had Canadians.
Right.
But for some reason, I think that the show is entirely devoted to Canadians now.
They take up a lot.
Like, I don't know why. I think that we've been totally... You know what? Canadian cuckold. This show should be called the goddamn Canadian cuckold. We've been cuckolded by these Canucks from Canada for far too long.
Well, that's nice, usually.
Seashells experiment right there that went awry.
We'll get some Canadian gooses.
So, Jim is the owner of Voodoo Comics.
Yeah.
You know, some of the shit that Jim sends me is, like, off the rails, never thought I would see it, which is awesome.
Okay.
First of all, because some of the stuff that we see, I mean, even though we deal with a lot of indie horror and indie genre stuff, we also deal with a lot of mainstream stuff. Mm-hmm. So we get a lot of mainstream stuff that sort of comes by our desk. But then occasionally we'll get the stuff that's really out there, really in left field. And I think that Jim specializes in a lot of that. Like, for some reason, Jim, this is... We're already off the rails. This did not take long.
Of course. You already went with the Canadian cuckold thing. So it's like,
where do we go from there?
There's nowhere to go but down.
We need to watch with a third hand.
Yeah.
So, now, I envision Jim to be sort of like the Johnny Depp character from Ninth Gate. Like, I think you're out there in like these small, like little niche markets where you're collecting obscura, you know? Is it that glamorous, Jim?
No, because it is because I end up doing worse and worse things as time goes on, but you like me more as that happens, just like the Ninth Gate.
This sounds an awful lot like Brom too.
did you ever notice the Ninth Gate that the least likable part of Johnny Depp's character is at the very beginning when he's doing less of the atrocious stuff. In the end, he's killing people and burning things down, and he's the nicest guy then. I don't know how they did that.
That's when he really endears himself to us.
Yeah, he's such a sweetheart at the end. It's like, he just killed 6 people and burned down a house.
and one of them was disabled to top it all off.
Yeah.
I mean, really just shooting for the fences.
Well, so now I've got a goal. I've got a few places to burn down. How much time do I have for that? Because if I've got a deadline, I got
to
get going.
Hey, we're close to Springfield. This whole place will catch a blaze pretty quickly.
And it wasn't me who set off the propane tank near downtown.
At least not this time. So tell us a little bit about, first of all, like, what is Voodoo Comics? What was the genesis of Voodoo Comics? And then what is Jim Lesniak to Voodoo Comics?
Well, Voodoo Comics in general, I started doing that for shows about 15, 16 years ago. And at that point, I just thought it was a cool name. And I didn't focus on the horror. It was your general comic stuff. So I would have single-digit issues of X-Men up on the wall. I'd have Silver Age stuff. I'd have a few Golden Age. And then around 2012, I realized the stuff I was trying to collect, other people should be looking for as well. And that I went pure horror. I literally bulked out my entire show stock to someone else, started from scratch, and built up a primarily horror and underground show stock. So stuff that you just don't see anywhere else. You come by and see me. And then around 2013, I thought, hey, wow, look at these cool soundtrack records. So I'll buy a few, throw them up on the wall, and I'll probably be sitting on these for a while. And I sold out 20, 30 records in 15 minutes at a show. Just gone. Hmm. So I started building up a network of distributors and record labels so I could pull any soundtrack records, all horror-related or weird-related. And it's more of an expression of my personality. I consider it more of a curated selection of stuff, because everyone can go out there and just have the general...
That sounds so very esoteric, too, by the way, Jim.
I try. I try. You want esoteric? I start scaring people the records I have available. I got Charlie Manson singing. I got Aleister Crowley speaking. Hmm. I have the only known recordings of castratos.
That's cool.
There's only 500 copies they pressed up, and I got a few of them left over. I have field recordings of actual voodoo rituals in the 1950s.
Now, let's... Okay. Now that you've obviously piqued my interest.
Right. I'm planning my Saturday now.
At this point, are these things that you have sought out, or have they sought you out?
It gets to be a little of both. There's, believe it or not, with one of my distribution chains, one of my distributors, they send me lists. Say, you might like this stuff. And the last list had the first of a, what's going to be a three-part series of field recordings of ghost investigations dating back to the early 1900s, including an exorcism.
Hmm.
But my people out there know what I'm looking for, and they come to me. With some of them, I start hunting it out, and after you've dug down a little bit, some of it just starts cascading your direction.
Right, yeah.
It's like the Lords of Salem record.
Right. Now, we're going to go down a bit of a different path here, Jim.
Sure.
As if we didn't see this one coming,
right?
Now, we're talking about field recordings of ghost investigations, voodoo rituals, exorcisms. Do you have even the tiniest belief in any of this at all?
I have a background in engineering. And I'm willing to listen to proof and see what's out there and keep an open mind. It's hard to 100% disprove anything.
Right.
But for me to really be hardcore and going, yeah, this is true, man, it's got to be irrefutable. I've got a scientific background, chemical engineering degree, and I was trained to look at data. And a lot of the stuff, I admit, they're curios. Is it real? I don't know. Is this someone's art project? I don't know. But you know what? I can sell this record for $30 at a convention. And it looks really cool.
Now see, I'm an art major. So basically, you could hold up a hot dog, throw your voice, and I'd swear to God it was alive. Not a whole lot of suspension of disbelief on my end.
Although, with the Voodoo Ritual record, this one I'll digress on because I love it so much. Copies that I got have silkscreen covers. They're recorded by a woman named Maya Darren. Have either of you ever heard of her?
The last name sounds familiar.
She was an avant-garde filmmaker in the 40s and did some crazy, not quite Un Chien Andalou level weird, but she just creepy, usually silent with someone recording a soundtrack, and she would do little documentary films. She went to Haiti to film a documentary. They trusted her. She was so fascinated by voodoo, they actually allowed her to record the rituals, and they initiated her into the voodoo religion. She was that hardcore, she joined. And then they've been releasing the recordings every so often.
And I thought I was hardcore, John.
See? You're not that hardcore.
I feel like I'm really low on the totem.
You know, not all of us can go and sacrifice a goat just because it's a Saturday.
Well, only
with Days of the Y in them, however. I have my standards.
Well, you gotta, if you do it every weekend, then it loses its appeal.
Yeah.
Oh, true. And then everybody's like, where the hell did my goat go?
It's all old hat.
Yeah.
That's how you want to know how to get run out of a village? That's how you get ran out of a village.
There you go. Yeah,
pretty much. We've already digressed, but I try to be esoteric. And then what the benefit is, if I actually go to a comic convention, I've been focusing on horror conventions since about 2012, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to branch back out to comic cons again. But if I'm at a comic con, I am not competing with the other dealers. Not in the slightest, because you know what? I don't care if you've got Amazing Spider-Man number 275. I don't have any Spider-Mans. I have no heroes, no hope over here. Uh-huh. You want a run of House of Secrets? I got you. Do you want a copy of Amputee Love? I've got two copies available at various price points. Yeah. Do you want Legion of Charlies? Yeah, I got you.
Nice.
Undergrounds, Independence, horror comics from the 70s. Most of these dealers don't carry them.
No. Now, is there a particular horror con that you do like, that you go to regularly?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear all that.
Is there a horror con that you go to regularly?
I had been going to Days of the Dead for several years. It's not really been able to hit my schedule this year. Mm-hmm. I have been going to Horror Hound, at least in the Cincinnati and Indianapolis shows.
Okay.
One of the killer ones I go to every year is Astronomicon.
Huh.
That has become one of my absolute favorites. It's actually run by the guys in Twisted.
Oh, okay. And where is that located?
That one's Detroit. It's absolutely one of my favorite cons of the year. But it's only happened twice, but the guys in the band dig horror.
Nice.
They are truly into horror, and they've got that comic book out from Source Point Press now.
Now, I have not seen the comic. I had an affiliation with them through an artist friend of mine who is doing mm-hmm. a lot of their promotional collateral. So mm-hmm. I've been aware of them. I did not realize that they were that into horror, however.
They are into it. With Jamie, he came by and his jaw hit the floor when I showed him the pre-code horror that I was bringing by. He knows what it is. He is a major fan. He has bought from me before at the shows when I had no idea who he was. I'm not sure about, this is bad. I know Jamie and I can't remember the other guy's stage name. I don't know if he's as into it, but most of their roster is deep into horror.
Now, for the uninitiated, let's talk about pre-code horror for a second.
Absolutely. Pre-code horror it's termed as the stuff before 1955. In the beginning of 1955, that's when you had the Comics Code come into effect. It was an effort to do an end run around federal regulation of the comic book industry. Prior to that, it was anything goes, pretty much. Your big pre-code horror company was EC Comics.
Right.
They're the ones that brought you Tales from the Crypt, Haunt of Fear, Vault of Horror, The Crypt Keeper, all came from EC, and they were the big target. What's fun with pre-code horror, not that I've done any talks on this before. I know you can tell I've never spoken about this.
And I think you're doing a great job, Jim.
Off the cuff. Do you realize why the congressional hearings started? Senator Kefauver was eyeing a presidential bid, and he had started off on a tough on crime stance, and he was going to go after the mafia. Then somehow he changed his mind about that. No one's really sure why, but the mafia is kind of tough to go after.
Yeah,
a little bit.
So he started going after comic books, and he had help in the form of Dr. Frederick Wortham, who wrote the book Seduction of the Innocent. And it turns out later on, decades later, someone went through his papers and discovered he falsified everything. every bit of the claimed research that Wortham did mm-hmm. was falsified, or he took one statement from one person and put it with someone else's actions and did it with some other location. Yeah. So he falsified everything to get a book deal. But they had the outrage of the parents because the comics were rotting children's minds. So they had congressional hearings. And unfortunately, Bill Gaines had just put out that Crimes of Sense stories number 22 with a severed head. So, of course, they go there. And do you think this is an appropriate for comic book for children? Of course, he said yes. It wasn't tasteless because if they've been showing the actual severed neck portion of the head, that would be tasteless.
Well, of course.
Well, yeah. I mean, geez.
So what Keyfire was going after the mafia at first, but he managed to make sure that the comic book people did the comics code, which kind of eviscerated the horror genre for several years in comics. And the other person he ended up going after, this is why everyone should hate Senator Kefauver, Betty Page. Because of him, Betty Page stopped modeling.
Oh, the bastard.
Yeah. Right there. You know, it's like, wait a second. He killed the Crypt Keeper and Betty Page's career.
Jeez.
This guy's the Hitler of the comic world.
You know, even Hitler going, dude, Betty Page, really?
Yeah, Betty Page, really? Come on.
Mm-hmm. But with pre-code, EC was not the most outrageous. They were just the most popular. The most outrageous were going to be companies like Comic Media. They put out weird, terror, and horrific, War Fury. There's some classic covers on there. The insides are back and forth. They're okay. The covers are phenomenal. Or you'll see companies like Fiction House. They would put out gorgeous books. Stories are okay. Harvey Comics, who you probably know from Casper and Little Devil and all that kind of stuff, they put out some of the best horror comics. Chamber of Chills is an infamous title, partially now because, you know, the Die, Die, My Darling 12-inch single cover for The Misfits?
Yes.
The wine glass? That was originally Chamber of Chills number 19.
Huh. Nice.
Interesting.
Glenn Danzig's got good taste in pre-code horror. I mean, the Misfits logo is taken from Famous Monsters in Filmland.
Right.
He is well-versed in that stuff. But that's... The Misfits stole from Harvey Comics.
Now, when we talk a lot about these pre-code comics, and specifically when we start talking about stuff like EC Comics, there was an abundance of anthology horror.
Yes.
When did we start to transition out of anthology horror and the world of horror comics?
There were some that were not anthologies, even in the pre-code era.
Okay.
The best one of those, and you can still find, you can get some reprints, but they're expensive, from PS Publishing, Frankenstein. And it was following the monster. The original run of Frankenstein with Prize Comics started in, I believe, 1941 in Prize Comics, the actual title. And
it was episodic.
It was episodic. Then later on, post-war, it became a humor title. They introduced it as a humor title. When horror became popular again, it became a horror comic again, and it was episodic issue to issue and built on with the monster's journey. So it was no longer an anthology. When it was a humor book, it was more done in one.
Right, yeah.
That book, which should get more credit than it does, Dick Briefer's art, both in the humor era and in the horror era, is absolutely phenomenal. I highly recommend it if you can find some of that. PS Publications did some hardcovers. They run you at least $50 a pop. The stuff is in the public domain, so anyone can reprint it. So hopefully, I've got some black and white reprints of it, but it's just so hard to find them. And when you individual issues of that go for $200 and $300 a pop. Ooh. But that was an outlier. Most of the horror that you saw in the pre-code era was anthologies. You've got your Adventures into the Unknown, which is the first ongoing horror title. Eerie Comics was there. None of them were continuing episodic stories. What you started seeing that more was post-Marvel Age. So when the Comics Code Authority loosened up in the early 70s to allow vampires and werewolves, then you saw Marvel Comics coming out with Werewolf by Night, Tomb of Dracula, their version of the Frankenstein monster. It was just not very common because for most of the publishers, they didn't care about continuity.
It was let's get it on the stand and then let's get it off the stand.
Exactly, because the kid who buys it this month might not get it next month.
Now, we saw a sort of a revitalization of the idea of spooky storytelling as far as comics went in what, the early 70s?
Early 70s. That's when the Comics Code lightened up again. What really pushed that, believe it or not, was Spider-Man. Around issues, Spider-Man issues 97, 98, 99, they wanted to do an anti-drug story. They were asked to do an anti-drug story by the FBI.
Okay.
And Stan Lee went ahead and had those published without Comics Code approval because the concept of drug use was against the Comics Code. Could not have that stamp on there. Once they saw that, oh, well, not only did we publish it without it, it sold just fine without it. Then later on, you saw that Green Lantern, Green Arrow run where they had the drug issues, had Comics Code approval because they revised it for modern Moritz. And in the revision, they wanted to do horror again. But you're looking around 1969 is also when DC changed House of Secrets and House of Mystery back to anthology horror.
Right.
Prior to that, there had been that donut era where they were House of Secrets had Eclipso as its star. Just wrap your head around Eclipso. Was a star. And then it switched over to the anthologies. And what you actually had in some of those were a few of the original EC guys had jumped in on those. But the horror wave really started in the magazine size stuff.
Right.
Because Creepy and Eerie did not need to get code approval because they're magazine size. So they obviously weren't being marketed towards children.
And was that largely just based on the format?
It was based on the format, 100%. That's why Mad Magazine went to magazine size. It had originally been a comic book, and that was the only EC publication that survived the code. Well, they did try to do a couple of prose picto fiction type books, and those failed miserably.
So we had some stuff come out that had some staying power, obviously. Even today, you know, Tomb of Dracula is looked fondly upon, and then when we start looking Secrets and Mystery, we start getting to DC and you know, Lean Wayne, Bernie Wrightson, Swamp Thing. So then we had, and again, it's like we sort of, it's interesting because horror comics seems very cyclical. Like, we have resurgences. We have brief periods, you know, maybe 71 through 74 where it seems it's sort of hot. And then we have this dip again. Now, then we started to have, especially probably in the, I would say, mid to late 80s, when people started to love this concept of, listen, we can be a kitchen sink press. You know, we can be these little gaslight presses. We can start releasing stuff that we are not intending for mainstream audiences to consume. And then for whatever reason, they do take off. For example, I was a huge fan of Quinn and Vigil's Faust.
Yes.
Which I thought was fantastic. But that was a book that obviously could not be widely received because the subject matter was so extreme.
Oh, absolutely, especially the last three or four issues where I don't even think it got distributed through Diamond. You had to go straight through Vigil.
Yeah. Now, did you read the complete run?
Yes.
What were your thoughts on that? I mean, at this point, there are so very few people that picked up the book and then, over 2 decades later, were able to actually finish it out.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've read them, so I remember the visceral violence of it all, but I'd have to reread it to really give a review on it.
But the fact that we had, I mean, and back then, it's strangely enough, we saw some new Vigil stuff in the, I would say, mid to late 90s with Avatar Press.
Mm-hmm.
But in my opinion, again, this is nothing against Vigil as an artist, but I saw a noticeable difference in quality.
Yes. Yes, he doesn't do as much of a detail, although he has done a couple of guest covers for Tim Tyler's Fiends magazine.
Okay.
That are phenomenal. Tim started off as an assistant, I believe, to Vigil.
Okay.
Way back in the Faust days. And Tim has his Rat House Press, Tim Tyler. And what he'll do is he'll kickstart it each issue. And I know where he prints through because it's the same place I print. So I know he can do as few as 25 copies.
Now let's talk about that for a minute, because we're obviously in a very, very different era. When people talk about self-publishing now, hell, it's a completely different ballgame from what self-publishing was 20 years ago.
Even 10 years ago.
So as far as self-publishing at this point, where are we at with comics and self-publishing? Is it all a crowdfund game at this point?
It really depends. That's where I'm seeing the most personal and innovative stuff coming out. The downside to being able to easily publish one issue is you may never get the remaining issues. They may never finish the story. Honestly, I have connections with two different printers. You only have to do a minimum order of 25 copies. And you can print anything you want. Anything, and you'll have it inside of 2 weeks.
That's pretty insane compared to, I mean, way back in the day, I had done some penciling. Mm-hmm. And I was doing some finishing, actually, which is a completely different ballgame. Mm-hmm. And I was still doing pages a day. You know, we were still on a page rate a day. Mm-hmm. And that was including getting your Bristols out on FedEx to make sure they go to the inker and then mm-hmm. the letterer and then the colorist. I mean, it was, you know, such a fly-by-night industry, even for the big publishers. The
right.
fact that we can print 25 books and that we can print them with that kind of turnaround, I mean, for the person who wants to self-publish, the idea that we have this accessibility now, I mean, I don't want to call it a golden era because I think we also have a lot of crap, but I do think that we have this accessibility that we never had before.
I never would have thought I'd be able to print up something. About a year and some change ago, I printed up a Voodoo Comics Presents number one, and it was Airboy versus the Rats. I reprinted stuff from 1948. Mm-hmm. Like, well, I did a full color 36-page comic, and I was able to sell it for $6 a pop. It could print as few as 25 copies.
Yeah.
I just put out a trade paperback, and I'm able to sell it for $25 a copy of an 80-page full color trade paperback. And you know how long it took them to get it to me after I approved the digital proof? 7 calendar days.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
I approved it, and that's including shipping from California.
So what is this doing to the major publishers, if anything? I mean, we're hearing the major publishers cry foul all the time. I mean, that they're just not getting the actual print sales that they, you know, anywhere near of what they need to keep themselves afloat. We are still seeing print sales. We are still seeing it happen. So what is the whole crowdfunding minimum book count really doing to the big guys?
I think it's going to be a death of 1,000 paper cuts. It's going to be little bits, because why should I work on your character, your book that you own, that if it gets to be a movie that makes $1 billion, yeah. for example, I might get a free ticket to the premiere.
Right, yeah.
Why should I? So you're going to see some of the more creative, off-the-wall, and even look at what DC has been doing lately. The more outre things that have come through, they're turning away. Even Image turned away something recently. I'm forgetting the, this is bad, but it was more of, they didn't like the material. They thought it was a Filipino American's examination of society, mm-hmm. and they didn't like it because it was just too controversial, too niche.
Right.
Right now, you can find. I mean, I just got in. Let's see, where's the stack going here? There's this incredible book out there called Raven Nevermore. Okay. It's done. The print quality is incredible. I want to know where these guys are printing because the cover stock is great. The colors are vibrant. The story is fantastic. The art's fantastic. They're crowdfunding it. Mm. They've already put everything on one of the online comics places where you can just download it.
Right.
But they're doing crowdfunding issue by issue. The whole series is done. They've let you know the series is done. We want to put it in print. And it's one of the more interesting storylines I've seen in a long time. Then you're also seeing guys like, there's a title called The Saturday Night Slasher. And they're putting it online. They weren't going to print anything, but they had enough demand that they did a small 50 to 100 comic book run print. And this is, it's innovative stuff. You don't see this from the big guys.
Right. But I guess it begs the question, though, Jim, is anybody making money in comics right now? And I hate that my question boils down to that, but yeah. It is the question. Is anybody really making money right now?
I would say Brian Polito's making a fortune.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, have you seen how many covers he puts out? And he's actually, that guy is the Gene Simmons of comic publishing.
Very true. Very, very true. I mean, an ad for the Brian Polito coffin.
Yep. And I mean, this was, his stuff is, his Kickstarters do fantastic. He's got a warehouse now. Genius on the pricing. Cause he would number 1 to 100.
Yeah.
For a while he's doing that. And he would charge you more if you wanted something, wanted number one. If it's a single digit issue, it costs a certain amount and it would be a floating numbers thing, and he would sell out every print run, and he's got to be making a fortune on this stuff. He's got such a fan base, but he's been building up a fan base since the Evil Ernie days.
Yeah, very true. Yeah.
From what I understand, the title Witches through Image, that makes more money for the creators than the stuff that they do for Marvel or DC.
Well, and I've heard that some of the stuff that are slanting more towards horror are in big competition with some of the actual hero books. I've heard that Immortal Hulk is doing huge things for Marvel right now.
I've heard rumors that Immortal Hulk is outselling Batman.
That is what I've heard as well. Yeah.
That's what I'm hearing through various channels. It's outselling Batman. But I don't know if that's specifically because it's a horror-slanted Hulk book or just by the sheer fact it's written well.
I think it might be a little bit of both. And I think it might be the fact that when you look back at some of the earlier Hulk books, it was a monster book.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't horror, it was a monster book. If you look back at the early Swamp Thing stuff, it's a monster book. If you look at early Man Thing, it's a monster book. A lot of these titles were monster books. You know, they really fit into that category of this is digestible, it's not too extreme, it's not necessarily scary, but it's creepy and it's spooky, it's a monster book. Right. And I think that there's definitely still a need for that. People like this stuff that sort of falls a little bit outside of, and especially now, because the superhero genre, let's face it, really isn't the superhero genre anymore. It's something completely different. And it sort of, it mutated into a forum for people to cut their teeth on superhero drama. And I think that's what they're still doing.
Yeah. A lot of the hero stuff is turning into trademark renewal theater.
Yeah. Yeah, and I used to be a fan of some staple books. I used to pick up a lot of X books, and I used to pick up a lot of Spidey books. I mean, in my heyday, when I was spending a whole lot of money at the comic book shop, I was spending a lot of money on core big publisher titles. Mm-hmm. And at that point, they still had some interest for me. I cannot tell you how many times I've tried to revisit the X-Men universe within the last past 10 years and haven't got two issues into it.
I have the first, 500-600 issues of X-Men, one up, complete run, and I dropped them. Because it got to the point where you had to have 6 or 8 titles a month just to keep the storyline going.
Yeah.
The only X-Men book I've bought in the last probably 5, maybe almost 10 years is Ed Piskor's book.
Which one is that? You have to refamiliarize myself with it.
He is the one, I'm forgetting the title of it off the top of my head, but he did his own overview of the entire X-Men, like 500-600 issues.
Interesting.
And he is a guy who did, give you an idea, he came more from the underground.
Mm-hmm.
X-Men Grand Design, okay. That's the title. He came from the underground. He did Hip Hop Family Tree. He's done all sorts of stuff. So he is an odd person to do X-Men.
Right, yeah.
And right there I thought, well, okay, Ed Piskor's doing this? Let me see what he's doing. And it is definitely a love letter to the X-Men of how they were, not necessarily how it is.
Well, and that was always what had attracted me to the X-Men originally, especially when I was younger. I mean, I probably started to get into the X-Men when I think a lot of kids did, around like 9 and 10 years old.
Yeah.
You know, we started to graduate from this idea of kid stuff, even though we were still kids, and we were having problems understanding the concept of, I have to worry about social things, I have to worry about fitting in, I have to worry about groups and cliques. And the idea of the X-Men was something that said, listen, you're not going to fit in.
Yeah.
And not fitting in it is your stronghold. Not fitting in is your sanctuary. And that in and of itself was so refreshing to me, because even when you were reading Captain America or even reading Spider-Man, even though Spider-Man had his trials, you know, these were heroes that could get together.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be fine around one another, but you felt that the X-Men would still be ostracized.
Right.
So you had the ability to say, here's the kid in the corner of the class that I could hang out with and nobody else would hang out with me. And the book represented that for me. But, you know, the last times that I've picked it up, I don't know where the heart is in that thing anymore, if there is any.
I can't follow it, and I hate to say that, but I dropped that, and I dropped the Avengers. Most of those core books, I'm not sure where they're coming from or going to anymore. I'm so lost. But with the X-Men, my subscription as a kid started the month before Days of Future Past.
Wow.
So I got those in the mail. I got that first issue, then I had to wait a month to see how it ended.
So you were really there for those universe building issues.
Yes, I started just after the death of Phoenix, which it took me years to end up finding, because there were no, you couldn't find back issues to save your life. Here in town, you had to deal with Sharon at Family Book Exchange, and you weren't going to find anything. And if it was something anyone wanted, she overcharged you for it. But I was getting X-Men during prime Claremont Byrne era.
Now, let's just for a second, because this is something that I don't hear a lot of people talk about on either other podcasts or even in off the cuff conversations dedicated to comics, is that people rarely talk about the fact that you know, there's two paths you can choose. There's what you can find in your comic book store that's readily available, and stuff that you might not be able to find. It seems that you have two camps that rarely sort of cross-pollinate. So, if I could pick your brain for a minute, Jim, especially for horror fans, what can horror fans currently find that has some value that's maybe on some of the more traveled stands, and what could horror fans find that maybe they got to dig a little bit for right now?
Well, if you're going to go for something that is findable, that you can go to your local comic shop and they might have it. Redneck from Image.
Okay.
That I've been very entertained by that. It's this oddball family of vampires, and some of them are older than others. Some of them have been vampires longer than others, but they need each other. The storylines are about them dealing with each other because they don't necessarily like each other, but they need each other. And sometimes things go horribly wrong. But Redneck is fantastic.
I like the idea of dysfunctional vampire families. Oh, yeah. Like that appeals to me anyways.
Yeah, that's my favorite vampire book since Sea of Red, which was also an Image title. Vampirates. It's vampire pirates. They're in a shipwreck and trapped, and someone lets them go. So then they're let loose on the modern world as vampire pirates.
Interesting. That is one that I had not read.
That's very much fun. But Redneck is still an ongoing.
Okay.
And it's not that old, so you can get into it a little bit easier.
Okay.
You can easily find the trades. That's one good thing about Image, is that they do collect their saleable runs into trade paperbacks on a regular basis. So you can jump in and get it. Also, you should probably start seeing collections coming through from IDW of Lock and Key. That series is completed.
Which I loved, by the way.
And they keep having rumors of a TV show, and I don't know if it's ever going to happen.
We've been two pilots in so far. Neither that have been picked up. Now, the rumor now is that Netflix has decided to give it the green, and they've decided to give it the green for 13 episodes. So that's the most official thing that I've heard. But mind you, this also comes after Fox saying that they had acquired it, produced a pilot, and then it was never purchased. And the same with Hulu. So who knows?
We can hope, because it's a fantastic series.
Most certainly, yeah.
Another book that's out there that's now more findable because it became a Netflix series, which is more, is less of your traditional horror, more of a character study, The End of the Fucking World. I don't know if you caught that series on Netflix.
It's in the queue.
Yeah.
It started off as mini comics from Charles Forsman.
Okay.
He does some of the most intense books you'll find out there. And because it became a series, it is usually available even at Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
And it's in a little mini hardcover from Fantagraphics. He also recently finished off a series called I Am Not Good With This. And that series is about a young lady who has some kind of brain power. She can make heads explode.
Nice.
But she's also a teenage girl in love.
Ooh. Which makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah.
Admittedly, when I was a teenage boy, teenage girls could make my head explode.
Yes.
Quite easily.
So you see, except there was no eviscera.
Right.
Give you an idea on Charles Forsman. His art style reminds me of the Black Flag flyer art. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
His name's escaping me. Raymond Pettibon. He reminds me of Raymond Pettibon's art.
Now, are you familiar with and have you picked up any of Gideon Falls at all?
I have not.
Have been reading that. Really like it. Really, really enjoy it. It's definitely got that indie horror feel to it, mixed in with it's very Lynchian. There's a lot of David Lynch aspects to it. Really, really good book. I was also a fan of it. I believe that it has now been completed, but The Woods.
I wasn't sure if The Woods had been completed. I had read part of that. I had not finished it. I think I was waiting for... Was that the Warren Ellis book? No, that was The Trees. The Trees.
Right.
Thinking the wrong thing.
Yeah, this had elements of The Mist to it. A high school gets transported to another world. Intact with everyone inside.
Is it more of an Americanized floating classroom?
Yes.
Gotcha.
Now, as far as stuff that people might not be able to find on ye olde regular comic stands, what's some of the underground stuff that's probably most appealed to you?
If you want something with zero socially redeeming value, if you can find yourself copies of Fukitor, Fukitor, that is Jason Carnes. He is the bloody heart of the underground these days. It is bloody. There's nudity. There's brains exploding. There's craziness. Blind dead.
You Templar had me a nudity, Jim.
well, you know, you're not wearing any pants, so it's all good. He stopped doing that. He did these as digest ones. This guy, give you an idea, what you have to know what his blogspot page is. Then you have to go there frequently to see if he's bothering to publish something. And then he warns you that it won't get there immediately because he's got to put it in an envelope and get to the post office, man. But it is just totally cartoony, over-the-top violence. I mean, I'm looking at a cover of one. I'm not sure which issue this is. But you've got a nude woman on a being sacrificed on a slab. Her intestines are spilled over. Throat is cut. She's still screaming in agony. And then there's these creatures that are indeterminate origin around her wearing SS-inspired robes.
Well,
and that's the cover.
Again, I might be sold on this book already.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is a best of out there from Fantagraphics, but if you can find the original digest size ones, because no one sells them when they come up, get these. I mean, you just get them, and I mean, let's see here. He's got a Conan parody, but he calls it KOK, the coming of, I'm assuming it's pronounced cock. So he's got this huge sword, and you know, it's when the dialogue, and I'm quoting, "Come and taste my sword, you fucking dickheads." And he's covered in blood, holding the sword at crotch level, and then the next page is him cutting off arms, legs, heads. One of these days I'll show you this one. Well, that
curiosity
one is
definitely peaked.
That one is completely over the top, and then another one that I just got in. And let me see, get the artist's name. The artist writer is Matthew Allison. And he's got this title called Kankor, K-A-N-K-O-R, or C-A-N-K-O-R, rather. And it's very much underground. When I say underground, hopefully everyone knows what I'm talking about. That there's the underground comics of the 60s and 70s just went batshit crazy. Mm-hmm. I'm talking over the top. Some people think, oh, you're talking about Zap Comics. No, I'm talking Death Rattle and Slow Death and Skull.
Yeah.
Where they did, it's an anthology, but this is a 4-issue series. Of course, he's out of print of issue 3. And it's just weird, incredibly detailed art. I think he's inspired by Shintaro Kago, which I don't know if that means anything to you. That's very body horror, along the lines of Junji Ito, but more detailed with the body horror. He also does fanzines. Those are hard to come by. And then more for, since I've been going with the outrageous, we'll do one for the kids. I'm not even kidding on here. There's Dwight McPherson has a line of comics called Hocus Pocus Comics, but his main title is The Imaginary Voyages of Edgar Allan Poe. And Poe is the main character, and this is truly all ages, not the sanitized, it's only good for a 5-year-old.
Right, yeah.
This is the old school all ages where a kid could read it or mom and dad could read it, and they'll both enjoy it. There's something for everyone. He just put out a slightly oversized trade paperback through Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to run 12 issues, I believe. He's already done 5. The first 4 are collected in trade paperback. The art's fantastic. The story is great. The last time I enjoyed a title with Poe as protagonist was Jason Asala's Poe,
right,
which he self-published for 6 issues, and then it was with Sirius. You've probably read it. Are you familiar with that one at all?
Yeah, that one I actually am, yeah.
I actually own a couple of the covers.
Now, we've talked about sort of what's, you know, in the Jest stream right now. Mm-hmm. What's coming out that's got you excited?
There's a few things that are reprint-wise that I think is going to hit a larger market. Sourcepoint Press has a trade paperback for The Rot coming out. That's in the current previews catalog. I was picking up the original series. I like the series enough that I actually bought the prototype Mego style action figure of the main character.
Nice.
The Rot is basically living cancer going out to attack people.
Right, yeah.
We'll just, you know, throw that out there. They're coming out with a trade paperback, having it all. I think trade paperbacks do more for building knowledge of things. I am also excited as they continue on the run with, you'll think I've got a total Poe thing going on here, but, you know, I guess I'm just a Poe boy. Nobody loves me. Edgar Allan Poe, Snifter of Terror from Ahoy Comics. That's been a fantastic anthology. Yeah, Ahoy Comics is doing great work. I'm looking forward to all of that. I'm looking forward to some of the work that's coming out from, guy did Strangers in Paradise.
Okay, yeah.
Especially since he's tying in all his universes. Rachel Rising is one of the best horror series
that came out. Yeah, I enjoyed that, yeah.
And he's been tying it into the Strangers of Paradise, Terry Moore. He's been tying into Strangers of Paradise, Echo, all of his series. He's starting to tie them together.
Now, we've covered a lot of ground in a very short amount of time. Now, as far as what you've got available through Vudu, where you're going to be next, where people can sort of see what you've got to offer, where can people find you online, Jim?
My main homes online are at voodoocomics.com, and I need to update that more often because lately, with the records and a lot of the comics, I've been more of a concierge, where I have a regular clientele, and I say, hey, I'm getting these in, and I don't even have a chance to put them online. But I'm going to start putting a lot of my back stock online there. I'm also on Facebook under Voodoo Comics. That's where you'll find the crazy memes, my snarky comments, and that usually gives my convention schedule. I'm off the road until Labor Day weekend, and I'll be in Indianapolis for the Indiana Comic Convention.
Okay.
So that'll be interesting. Then I go back to Indianapolis the next weekend for Horror Hound.
Horror Hound's got a pretty good lineup this year.
It usually does. Nathan's been knocking out of the park with the lineup. It's... Part of me is thinking he gets too many people in, but it's not my convention, and I still buy tables.
Yeah.
But those are the shows I'm going to be at. But what I always tell people is if there's something you're interested in, email me, because it's hard for me to put – I have several thousand back issues.
Right.
And I had one guy shocked as he came up to my table. I was at Retro Invasion weekend. Mm-hmm. So, do you have any Gore Shriek? And I pulled out the short box. It's all Gore Shriek. It's like, I got everything but issue 6.5. He spreads it out and sees that I have 30 copies of Gore Shriek number one and took a picture to send to a friend.
Oh, that was one of my early convention purchases, was Gore Shriek number one.
It's an excellent title. And, of course, you know, they were hoping to reprint all of that.
Yeah. And what's the status on that?
Probably not going to ever happen.
Really?
I hate to speak for Tom Sklon over at Fanico, because they really are starting to fire back up. A few months ago, they put out the limited edition Night of the Living Dead, which is available at voodoocomics.com, in the signed edition, signed by one of five members of the original cast. They're reissuing that. They're doing a new Gore Shriek. There's a Gore Shriek Chronicles that came out through them that I had a big hand in doing an index on. But unfortunately, Tom is unable to get everyone to sign off to allow it to be reprinted.
Gotcha.
And there are a lot of people. He will not tell me who. I can kind of guess. I can read between the lines.
Right.
But it will most likely never be reprinted, any of the anthology issues. There is some talk, no confirmation yet, that the Pure Gurch issues will get reprinted. Because Gurch and Singh has come out of the mists for the first time in about 25 years. He's got new covers on Gore Shriek Resurrectus number 2.
Okay.
Those are available through Rough House Comics. I may end up getting some of those, but those are ones where something like that, I almost push towards the actual publishers so they can make more money.
Right.
Same with some of the record labels. But I do not believe that you'll ever see full reprints of Gore Shriek. They're going to continue on with new volumes. And there's, unfortunately, with confusion, you're going to have some from Rough House and some from Fantico.
Right, yeah.
There's going to be a trade paperback of Delectus Volume 2, but I'm not sure what's going to be in that. I think it's new material. And, of course, he's got the Deep Red magazine coming out again.
Okay, awesome. In fact, that was going to be one of my next questions because the two are so synonymous.
Mm-hmm. Deep Red, they did a volume last year. It was running really late, but I've got the – they did a hardcover and a softcover of number one. And number two was actually offered in previews, I think, last month or the month before. So it's in process. Deep Red is back, and they're doing it in book size because that has more of a shelf life. I mean, it's the same thing Fangoria is doing, but probably more successfully.
Right. Do you have a couple moments off the air for us,
Jim? Absolutely.
We want to thank you so much for being on with us tonight. Like I said, we've covered so much ground. Yep. We can't wait to have you back on because I feel like, especially when we start talking about the underground stuff, this is some pretty unexplored territory, even for me. And I would really like to know more about especially some of these creators that are taking advantage of the new era of self-publishing and really able to give us stuff that we haven't seen before. I urge everyone who's listening, definitely head on over to Voodoo Comics. Take a look at Voodoo Comics on Facebook and see exactly where Jim and Voodoo Comics is going to be next. And thanks again, Jim. Thank you so much for being on with us tonight.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. You know, I always talk about comics.
Well, and we'll always listen.